I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. We live in a world where habitat is so fragmented that it cannot support the food and shelter that plants and animals need to survive. What if there were a way to reconnect that environment and rebuild species? That intriguing question was at the heart of a recent sold-out event at WHYY, my interview with University of Delaware ecologist Doug Tallamy. He's the author of Nature's Best Hope, a new approach to conservation that starts in your yard. Today on The Connection, you get to hear our conversation about the role we can all play in restoring our shared environment. It's easy to feel dispirited about the future of the planet. 2023 was the hottest year on record. We're seeing sea level rise. We're seeing more violent storms. We're seeing floods and droughts. And we're seeing bird and insect numbers that are in decline. But giving up is not an option. And the good news and the purpose for tonight's interview is that there are things that you and I can do to help restore our ecosystem. Our guest, Doug Tallamy, has a down-to-earth idea. It's a way of rethinking conservation, and it involves that patch of green around your house or your apartment, which is basically a dead zone. He says, shrink your lawn, remove the invasive plants, replace them with native plants, and protect the natural area. And voila, or over time, you'll see an increase in biodiversity, and you will help to reduce climate change by literally removing CO2 from the air. His grand idea is called the Homegrown National Park, and it's the creation of an interconnected network of lands, people's yards, to create habitats for birds, insects, and pollinators. He writes in his book, Nature's Best Hope, think of your property as a small piece of a giant puzzle, which when assembled has the potential to form a beautiful ecological puzzle. Doug is a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. Let's give him a big round of applause. As I said, you have a lot of fans here.
It's embarrassing. Yeah.
It's embarrassing. I will embarrass you just one more time. One of the people I was talking to here said, oh, Doug Tallamy, the Jimi Hendrix of the native Jimi plant Hendrix. World.
Not the Taylor Swift?
No.
Jimi Hendrix
someday.
Is
it's
dead.
It's coming. Yes. Well, thank you for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
Where do you get, this book is about nature's best hope. Where do you get your optimism?
From you people. Look at today. There's 300 people here. You know, I've been talking about this for 20 years, and I see the needle moving in the right direction. More and more people are not just interested, they're acting. There's my motivation right there. Now, there's a lot of people that don't know anything about this. So I say, okay, I'm not done yet. Got to keep working. But it is working. So that's what gives me the motivation.
And it's one of the reasons that we're talking tonight. Yeah, so go ahead.
It's also the only solution. There's millions of us. So that's millions of future conservationists. You know, if we do it with a few conservation biologists, few ecologists, it's not going to work. If we wait for policy to change, we've been waiting a long time. But each one of us can take action right where we live, our little piece of the earth, and make it happen.
There's a thing called learned helplessness, which is, you know, you keep getting zapped and you keep getting bad news and you keep getting told that the world is going to end. And then you eventually give up.
Yeah. The world is going to end if we do nothing. So there you go. We'll do something.
Where did you get this idea of this homegrown national park? Was it a walking in your yard and having an aha moment, or was it something that evolved over time?
It wasn't an aha moment, but it wasn't my yard. It was my kitchen table, and this
good
was
place
this
to
was
work.
Around, I don't know, 2005, I think. I saw a study by Christine Malesi, I think her name was, measured the amount of lawn that we have in this country, and back then it was 40 million acres. I said, well, how big is 40 million acres? And it turns out it's bigger than all of New England combined. But then I started adding up the real national parks in the country, and I added up all the major ones, and it was still less than 20 million acres. So I said, well, if we cut the area of lawn in half, we can make a new national park. We're going to do it at home, so we'll call it Homegrown National Park. And that was it. 5 minutes later, it was born.
Well, that was quick. But that was 2005, so that was 20 years
ago.
That
was the idea.
That was the idea.
That was the idea. But, you know, you may have noticed I talk, but I don't do anything. So it really wasn't until, 2019? I was giving a talk in Connecticut, and Michelle Alfandari, who had just retired from a licensing career in Manhattan, she was the quintessential member of the non-choir. She knew nothing about nature, didn't know there was a problem, wasn't attracted to it, but she had retired and her husband wanted to move to Connecticut. So her neighbor said, you should go and hear this talk. So she did. And she came up to me after me. She said, you know, you're not reaching your target audience. You just talk to the choir. And I said, well, it's only the choir that invites me. She said, you have to use social media. You really should make a small nonprofit and do all the things. I said, I don't do that. She said, I do. And that's how the real Homegrown was born.
If we roll back the clock, I'm not sure how far to go back, but nonetheless, and look at a well-functioning ecosystem. You've got plants and you've got insects. How does this work when it's working right?
Well, you have plants, you have the things that eat those plants. Most of them are insects, but other things as well. Then you have the things that eat those things. So you have layers of natural enemies that keep all the herbivores in check. We run into trouble when we have plants and maybe one herbivore and no predators, think deer. And then they just go crazy. There's nothing to control them. So a well-functioning ecosystem has all the trophic levels to keep it in balance.
Right.
And when you're missing one, there's an issue.
But you say an interesting thing in this book about plants. The plants, you know, they're fairly adaptable, not entirely. But when it comes to the critters that live off of them, that they are very specialized. So you have this, it's not exactly a mismatch, but it's an interesting connection, for lack of a better word.
You know, plants are capturing energy from the sun, and they turn it into the food that supports all the animal life, except for a few little things at the bottom of the ocean. So plants are making the food. If you don't get that food to the animals, you don't have any animals. And if you don't have animals, you don't have functional ecosystems. Well, plants aren't anxious to share that food. They want to use it for their own growth and reproduction. So they defend their tissues. And that's the rub there. The herbivores want to eat the plants, but the plants say, no, I'm going to taste bad. So the only ones that can eat a particular plant are the ones that have adapted to that particular set of defenses. And I always use the monarch butterfly as an example because they're specialists on milkweeds. We all know that. Well, milkweeds are toxic plants. Don't eat a milkweed. Because if you do, if you eat enough of it, it will stop your heart. That's cardiac glycosides that are in there. But the monarchs have enzymes that detoxify and store it and excrete cardiac glycosides. They also have, milkweeds have sticky latex sap. That gums on exposure to air. So if a caterpillar eats it, it glues its mouth part shut. And that's the defense. Well, monarch butterfly caterpillars crawl onto the leaf, and the first thing they do is snip the midrib of the leaf. They chew right through it, and it blocks the flow of that sticky latex sap. Then the rest of the leaf is latex-free, and they can eat it. That's a simple behavioral adaptation that most insects don't have.
Right.
So they have specialized on milkweed. But in doing that, they haven't specialized anything else. So you take away the milkweed, you lose the monarch. And 90% of the insects that eat plants are specialists just like that.
Right. So whatever.
So when we bring in plants from other continents, there's no way they could have specialized on it. And that's the problem.
You quote E.O. Wilson a lot in your book, and he's very quotable. And he famously said, you wrote this in your book, if all mankind were to disappear, the world would regenerate back to the rich state of equilibrium that existed 10,000 years ago. If insects were to vanish, the environment would collapse in chaos.
And we would disappear.
And we would go along with the insects. Quickly, right. It would go quickly. It's hard to imagine a world without insects.
He gives us a couple of months. You know, what would happen is the flowering plants would disappear. Because they're pollinating 90% of the flowering plants. And that would destroy the food webs, that transfer of energy that supports our vertebrate animals. So the mammals, the birds, the amphibians, the reptiles would all disappear. We're mammals, by the way.
Right.
The decomposers would be gone. So he says the earth would rot because we'd always have his bacteria and fungi.
Right.
Right now it's insects that are rapidly turning over. 90% of that biomass that's out there is not eaten. It just dies, and it's got to be recycled. And that's what insect decomposers are doing. So when you lose insects, he calls them the little things that run the world, and they do.
Yeah.
And we are losing our insects. The last figure I saw is we've lost 75% of them.
Wow.
In 2014, there was a big study, and they said we've lost 45%. By we, I mean the globe. Now, 75%, not that much longer. Mm-hmm. So it's not going in the right direction. We're not being nice to our insects.
Right, and we obviously need them in order for us to survive. I wonder whether that tells us something about how we view nature and our role, our place in nature. And I think there's this impulse among human beings to control things, you know, to get Mosquito Joe to come and take care of all the bugs in your backyard. Speak to that.
He will take care of all the bugs.
Yeah,
Not just mosquitoes, yeah. Most people do not see that they have a role in nature. They're not part of nature. Nature's someplace else.
Right.
A lot of people like nature, but they don't see it as being essential. And it is definitely someplace else. They don't want to share their spaces with it. Well, we're everywhere. If we don't share human-dominated spaces with nature, it's gone. And that's the problem. So we've lost the connection with the natural world that supports us. We hear the term ecosystem services. It's our life support that is produced by living beings, plants and animals, and the communities that knit them together. And we need functioning ecosystems making life support everywhere, not just in parks and preserves. Because we do have parks and preserves, but they're tiny little things that they're, you know, not nearly enough. So that's our yards too.
We do have all these impervious surfaces. I mean, we're not going to dig up, you know, 6th Street here or 7th Street here.
Right. But the percentage of the country the percentage of the country that's paved over is bigger than Ohio. I was going to say it's not much. It's a lot.
Yeah.
But it's what we're doing with the rest of the land. It's what we're not doing with the rest of the land. You know, almost half of the country is in some form of agriculture. And then we've got this matrix of cities and suburbs and little teeny habitat patches in the other half. We have to treat those other halves a whole lot better than we do. We've got to improve what we do in agriculture, too. And there's ways we could do it without decreasing yield at all. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of understanding how important these life support services are, what generates them, and what destroys them.
That's ecologist Doug Tallamy talking about his idea, the homegrown national park, before a packed studio audience at WHYY. Much more after a very short break. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL. I'm Marty Moscoway, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY. It's an interview with ecologist Doug Tallamy about the role we can play in restoring our shared environment by turning our backyards, no matter how small, into interconnected conservation corridors, using native plants to attract bees and insects, especially pollinators. When we left off, we were talking about the amount of land in the U.S. that's in private hands, used for agriculture and for lawns.
Thinking of all that land, that open land, there's a lot of pesticides, herbicides, the use of water, and then all the runoff that comes from that.
Yeah. You know, if you have a little home garden and you buy a package of corn seeds, they're going to be pink or maybe purple. That's a seed coating. That's a neonicotinoid seed coating, which is now on all the seeds. It's an insecticide. It's 7,000 times more toxic to insects than DDT was.
Wow.
And only 5% is taken up by the plant. 95% washes off into the watershed or blows away on dust. We have no idea what's happening there. And the interesting thing is, if you compare a field where you use seed coatings, neonicotinoid seed coatings, with one where you didn't, there's no increase in yield. So we're doing it for absolutely nothing. Whether you have an insect problem or not, you do it. That, you know, that's just insanity. That's got to change.
How do we end up with all these invasives? Bamboo, kudzu, English ivy. I mean, it's a long list.
It's a long list. You've just named the things that are in our local nurseries.
Exactly. Well, that's how, right?
That's how. A few of them got here accidentally, but most of them are sold in nurseries.
Wow.
85%. I'm forgetting my own statistics, but something like 85% of the woody invasive plants in our countries are escapees from our garden. So, right. And the big ones we brought in purposefully for ornamental purposes.
I'm thinking of the beautiful springs that we have here in the Delaware Valley and the azaleas and the rhododendrons and all the colors. Are they invasives? Are they bad guys?
Okay, now we have to get to definitions.
Right.
Invasives are non-native plants that are displacing native plant communities. Right. There's a net loss in ecosystem productivity. But there are many non-native plants that are not invasive. So right. They're not moving around. Your ginkgo, your azaleas, right. Your rhododendrons, they're not moving around at all. Now, they are occupying a lot of space. We've got 135 million acres of residential neighborhoods, and about 80% of them are planted with non-natives. And some of them, calorie pear, privet, burning bush, barberry, those are really invasive. But there are many that are not invasive. So we don't want to, it's not that all non-natives are
right.
invasives.
Yeah. Right. But they do, I mean, birds live in them. And I mean, I guess, what is our relationship to non-native plants?
Yeah. Well, that's mostly how these invasive plants are getting around. Birds eat the berries and then poop right. them out someplace else.
Right.
So people say, well, good, it's helping the birds. Trouble is, birds rear their young on insects, not on berries. They're eating the berries at other times of the year. And they're always eating insects when they're available. So 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. These plants don't make the insects.
Right.
So the birds don't get to reproduce. And I'm mostly talking about caterpillars. And I'm talking about a lot of caterpillars. You've all heard the statistic. For one clutch of chickadees, it's 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars. To get them to fledge, and then after they fledge, the parents continue to feed them caterpillars another 21 days. So it's really tens of thousands of caterpillars to make a bird that's a third of an ounce. That's one nest,
right.
And we want chickadees and cardinals and titmice and robins, and we want everything. You need a lot of caterpillars out there, and your crepe myrtle and your ginkgo and your hostas are not making any. So that's the problem, which is one of the reasons we have lost 3 billion breeding birds in this country in the last 50 years.
Because of the loss of caterpillar.
It's one of the reasons. You know, smashing into windows takes another right. billion. House cats takes another 2 to 3 billion.
Wow.
We're killing our birds from all different angles. So,
thinking of those caterpillars, you also say if you have a tree, make a nice big circle
right,
around
yeah.
that tree so that they fall
soft
out.
Soft landing.
A soft landing as opposed to into the grass.
Yeah, it's our woody plants that are making most of those caterpillars, and they're mostly trees, and they develop as caterpillars up in the canopy. But when they're finished growing, they don't stay there. They drop from the tree and they try to pupate underground. They wiggle their way under the ground, or they spin a cocoon in the leaf litter that's under the tree. And if you drive down the street, look at what's under the tree. It's grass that is mowed and compacted. So it's very difficult for the caterpillars to get underground. And there's no leaf litter for them to pupate under. So, and that would be, I mean, we always talk about cutting the lawn in half, that's a great way to do it.
And you say clover over grass. I mean, if you're going to have a yard, have lots of clover.
Clover at least is fixing nitrogen. You will not have to fertilize your lawn. And it's blooming. So the generalist pollinators, things like honeybees and mm. bumblebees, will go to your clover. And nothing goes to, there's no resource for pollinators and grass. When we talk about no mow May, you don't mow in May, you get tall, cool season European grass. It's not a resource, whether it's tall or short. So we need no-mow areas that are well planted with the sequence of blooming plants that our pollinators need from April all the way to the end of October.
What are the plants that are native to this region here that people should, if not consider putting them in their yard, at least understand how they operate?
Well, if you want to make a pollinator garden, the idea is to plant for the specialist pollinators, the ones that can only reproduce on particular plants. So what are those plants? The best plants for specialist pollinators are goldenrods, any of the goldenrods, native asters, evening primrose, perennial sunflowers, anything in the genus Helianthus. Those are the top genera. And if you have those in your yard, you'll have, you know, 40, 50 species of bees that can breed in your yard that can't without those plants. The good thing about planting for the specialist is that the generalist can use those plants as well. If you only plant for the specialist, then you lose your generalists. And we've got almost 4,000 species of native bees, and a third of them are specialists. So it's really a lot of species that we don't want to lose.
And what about the honeybee? What should we know about the honeybee?
Honeybee is a non-native. It's our non-native agricultural pollinator. We brought it over when we brought over all of our crops from Europe. It's a wonderful pollinator. It's a wonderful generalist pollinator, and it's important for a number of our crops. The problem with honeybees, in terms of maintaining this diverse ecosystem, is that a single hive will have 30,000 bees in it, and they can forage up to 2 miles from the hive. So a single hive can saturate 8,000 acres. And if you have a bunch of hives, there's no way that can happen without taking the pollen and nectar that our native bees have. So when we, you know, for agriculture, that's great. Hobbyists, though, really are hurting the native bee populations. Yeah. They're doing it for fun, and they think they're helping the pollinators. They're actually hurting the pollinators.
Oh,
I don't like to spread that message. It just happens to be the truth.
Too late now. You love the oak tree.
I do.
You do. You write a lot about oak trees.
Right.
Why?
You want to know why.
Yeah. I do.
To me, the most interesting thing that we have discovered in our lab is that it's not just native plants versus non-native plants. It's productive plants versus unproductive plants. And it turns out there's a lot of native plants that aren't all that productive either. It further turns out that just 14% of the native plants in this country are supporting 90% of those caterpillars that are driving that food web. And oaks are the number one. They're supporting more than 950 species of caterpillars nationwide.
Wow.
550 species in the mid-Atlantic states. Whereas tulip trees, they're good trees. They support 21. Wow. So they're native, and we do want them. You don't want a monoculture of tulips. But there's a huge difference among the, we call them keystone plants. So oaks and cherries and native willows are really high. So,
and oak, they're slow growers, right? I mean, you have to be patient.
They're slow when they're little. I planted the oaks at my yard in the year 2001, really, as acorns. And today they're 60, 70 feet tall. So I don't consider that real slow growing.
No. That's really impressive. How do you get buy-in? I mean, I can imagine people here that either are doing what you're talking about or thinking about it. How do you get buy-in? Because the idea of these interconnected corridors is neighbors working together.
Yeah, that's the solution. If our parks and preserves are not enough, we have to do conservation outside of the parks and preserves, and that's on our private property. So that's on everybody's property here. How do you get buy-in? I've been trying to discover the silver bullet for that.
Right.
I'd love to interview each one of you and say, why are you here? You know, what is it about this message that you like? And I think one of the things that really works is the message of empowerment, because people are concerned about the state of the planet, but they all think there's nothing one person can do. Now, I just have a big list. Oh, you can shrink your lawn, you can modify your lights, you can fire Mosquito Joe. There's a whole bunch of things you can do and see the results. So that empowerment, I think, is creating a lot of buy-in.
You have a couple of lines about a woman in Chicago who lives on a tenth of an acre, so that's really little. And she has now 127 species of birds that would come and visit her, I guess, during the year.
Right. That's Pam Carlson's house. Her property abuts O'Hare Airport. One-tenth of an acre is 3 times smaller than the average lot size in North America. So it's a tiny little piece. She's not attached to or connected to any natural area. So she's a tiny little island. She's not just somebody who uses native plants. She's a native plant designer, and she's really good at it.
Wow.
So I like to show pictures of her yard because the old, native plants are ugly. Not at Pam's house, they're not. But, you know, Pam has a tenth of an acre. What about everybody who's in an apartment who only has a porch, a balcony?
Or a pot.
Yeah, that's container gardening. And you know, we're really starting to think about that because 82% of us live in cities. Everybody has to be involved with this. So if you actually go to our website, homegrownnationalpark.org, and look at the section about container gardening, you can now find the appropriate native plants for containers in your ecoregion, anywhere in the country, to try to empower people who think they can't do anything.
And there's the mental health aspect of all of this as well. I mean, I was talking to a couple of people here, just the pleasure of working in dirt and doing something and then seeing the result.
In soil, Marty.
In soil. Ooh. is faux pas, right?
Dirt is what's in my house.
Soil.
Yeah, the research showing the health benefits of any exposure to nature is really incredible. It's almost unbelievable, but... And I haven't done this research, but 15 minutes in front of a tree or walking around with flowers can lower your blood pressure, can lower your stress hormone. So it reduces your stress, and that's really the key, because when your stress is reduced, you do everything better. You learn better, you're happier, you're a nicer person, there's fewer divorces, your cancer gets cured, all kinds of things happen. Really, there's evidence for all of this stuff. And the key seems to be lowering that stress hormone, which creates all of those problems. And it's underappreciated, but it's real.
But it's real, absolutely. I wonder how resilient you think of nature, again, broadly speaking, how resilient is it? And, I mean, we do a lot of stuff to it and with it. But in the end, maybe quoting E.O. Wilson, does nature win out?
Nature's extremely resilient. And I'm getting more and more examples of how resilient it is. I'll start with our property where my wife Cindy and I live. We got 10 acres of a old farm that had been broken up, and it was mowed for hay before we moved in. So very few plants there. And we put the plants back and remove the invasive. That's a huge part of it. But now I have the ability to measure our progress, and I do it by taking a picture of every moth species that is now making a living on our property because we put the plants that those moths need. And I got 3 more last night.
Wow.
So I am up to 1,288 species are there now. What I don't know is what was there when we started, but I guarantee it wasn't very much. It wasn't very much. So that's resiliency right there. I met a woman in Ohio just a couple days ago who said, have you heard of Mentor Marsh in Ohio? No, I haven't heard about it. Well, it was the biggest Phragmites stand in Ohio. It was over 800 acres of Phragmites, and she showed me a picture of it.
What's Phragmites?
That is the common reed. That is that's terrible invasive in aquatic plants, communities. If you drive up the Jersey Turnpike, the Meadowlands, solid Phragmites.
Wow.
You know. It's gone. Just the seed bank has replenished the aquatic plants that are there. There's 2 endangered species that have come back on their own when they got rid of the Phragmites. That's 800 acres there. There's a place in Illinois called the Nachusa Grasslands that has recorded, I guess it's over 750 species of plants. What's the figure of birds? I don't know. Several hundred bird species have been recorded there. It used to be a cornfield. So, yes, we can put it back. And with that container gardening, we can put it back almost anywhere. Not totally.
Right.
But a whole lot more than people think.
Right. What's your definition of a weed?
A plant out of place. So people tell me native plants are out of place? I don't think so.
Yeah.
They belong here. It's the ginkgo that's out of place. And now I know what they're saying. You know, you have your garden. This is your design garden. You don't want anything else in there. And that's how we came up with the term weed. We, meaning Europeans, came over and wanted to farm in our monoculture way. You know, the Native Americans had a number of crops, including anything else, growing up in the field. But Europeans didn't like that. So we grew monocultures of corn. And any plant that popped up in those fields early on was called a weed. New York ironweed, milkweed. Right. So that's how the term got associated with it. And of course, it's a pejorative term. So if it's a weed, we got to get rid of it. I want to call milkweed Monarch's Delight. You know, then everybody will want
it.
You know,
that totally works. Let's talk about lights. I mean, cities are just beaming light, you know, 24/7. But I'm thinking about people's backyards, and oftentimes you can see very lovely lighting that highlights a lovely plant or maybe a little bunny statue somewhere. What do you think about lights?
Yeah, we're addicted to light. We want to make the night the day.
Yeah.
And so we've lit up everything. It's really just a habit. We can always throw out security as a reason for doing this, but we do it unnecessarily a whole bunch. And light pollution, it turns out, is a major cause of insect declines.
Yeah.
Because insects, about 80% of the insects that are out there are attracted to lights at night. And most of those are the moths that are making the caterpillars that run our food webs. So we have a couple choices there. It's a terrible problem, but has a very easy solution. And we don't have many of those.
No, we don't.
One is turn out the light. That's easy.
Yeah.
If you don't want to do that, and I understand why you might not want to, you can put a motion sensor on it, so it only turns on when the bad man comes. And if you don't want to do that, take the white bulb out of your security light and put in a yellow bulb. That's the easiest thing to do. And actually, people suggest, why don't you tell them to put in a red bulb? And ecologically, that is the thing to do, because our animals, and they can't even see the red wavelengths, so they think it's still night. But
red has
red
a different
light
connotation
district. Yeah,
for,
I don't know.
But for the human
population. We'll go with yellow at this point. But that right away would just about end the slaughter that happens at our lights.
Yeah.
And you go to the hardware store now and get, they call them bug lights. It sounds like it's going to kill your bugs, but it actually will save them.
Right. But just thinking about cities, I mean, I guess that's why we've got so many dead birds and sort of a wasteland.
It's one of the reasons. I mean, birds will smash into windows even without lights. But during migration, when you have lights on these big towers, thousands of birds fly into them.
Yeah.
So the lights at the 9/11 site that they beam up into the sky on 9/11, that is peak migration time. And so they're now watching, you can watch the bird migrations through radar. So they know when they're coming, and they'll turn them off for a couple hours and the birds will get through.
That's ecologist Doug Tallamy. His most recent book is Nature's Best Hope, a new approach to conservation that starts in your yard. More after a very short break. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
You're listening to The Connection on WHYY. Today we're focusing on our connection to the natural world, how to support the birds, bugs, and especially the pollinators who make life possible for all of us. We need them more than they need us. Our guest is Doug Tallamy, University of Delaware ecologist, in an interview that we recorded at WHYY before a sold-out audience.
You have an interesting critique of the Endangered Species Act. I remember talking to you about this a couple of years ago, basically saying that it has focused on one species rather than looking at this whole web and this whole intersection of insects and wildlife.
Right. No species lives in isolation of the ecosystem that supports us. So a much more productive approach would be to save the ecosystem in which this endangered creature is. And I understand the constraints there, because then you're talking about thousands of species, and legally it becomes pretty complex. But we need to be thinking that way. My other criticism is that the Endangered Species Act was written based on sticks rather than carrots.
Right.
If you have an endangered species on your property, we're going to fine you if you do anything with your property. And it became a very negative thing. So people would shoot the endangered species so that they wouldn't have any constraints. We should pay somebody to take care of that species on your property.
Some carrots.
We're going to have carrots, right. And they're actually starting to do that. There's Marco Island off of Florida has burrowing owls on it. And they're paying people to allow the burrowing owls to burrow in the front yard.
Oh, wow.
Now everybody wants a burrowing owl. I mean, that, it's a very
simple solution.
They say, where would the money come from? It come from, you know, not litigating everybody. We have the money. We can find it.
What I like so much about your ideas is that sort of rather than punishing people or telling people you have to turn down the thermostat or sell your car you know, get a bicycle instead of a car, it's more additive as opposed to subtractive.
Incentives work.
Yeah.
They really do. Yeah. You know, California, for every square foot of lawn you remove, you get a $3 rebate. That's a financial incentive. You're not going to get rich off of it, but it tells your neighbor this is culturally the right thing to do. I'm the good guy. You know who the... Maybe I shouldn't say this.
Go ahead.
Who's the biggest water abuser in California? It's Kim Kardashian.
Oh.
And the sad part is she's very proud of it. She's got the biggest lawn because she's the neatest person.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
This is the culture we've got to change, so...
All right, let's talk about deer. We'll go from Kim Kardashian to deer.
All right, yeah.
Who's more destructive, us or the deer?
Ooh. Well, we've created the deer problem,
have,
so I'm
going
to
yes.
say it's us. But
they destroy underbrush, in part.
You know, people want to come to my house so they can see our wonderful native plant garden. Every year it gets worse because of the overabundance of deer. We've got deer 5, 10, 15 times over the carrying capacity, the ability of the environment to support them. We have a browse line everywhere. There's no understory. And they eat the native plants and they don't eat the invasive plants. So it's a solid bed of Japanese stilt grass. Most of the invasive plants that we think are such super plants, they are not super plants. It's just that the deer won't eat them.
Right.
They eat the oaks. They eat all the other things that come up. With a few minor exceptions like spicebush. So you go into a forest now, the only understory plant is spicebush. The understory ought to be young canopy trees waiting for a light gap. But right now there's none because the deer have eaten them all. So what happens when those trees age out? Then you don't have a forest anymore.
So, too many deer.
What do we do about it? Yeah. Well, we could listen to Bernd Blossi at Cornell, who's written a lot about this. He's a top-notch ecologist. And we have to get the deer numbers down. People used to think, well, we'll catch them and move them someplace else. There is no someplace else now.
No,
there's
everywhere.
A deer problem from coast to coast. He says market hunting.
Market
hunting for
food.
Yeah, there are deer hunters. There'll be no season. You hunt them. Right. Now, there's got to be regulations. We'd have to change everything. We have to change our culture.
But we have created a lovely pile of food for them, to kind of a smorgasbord of food.
And a predator-free space.
Right.
The only predator now in most places, you know, hunters cannot hunt in suburbia. So the predators these days are cars. So believe me, the insurance companies are all for this there. Not only that, it's somewhere around 1,000 people a year are killed by deer with car collisions, which is, you know, several times more than die from West Nile virus. We're spraying the world to kill mosquitoes because of West Nile, but we don't care about the deer. So risk assessment.
Yeah. I mean, it's Bambi and all that, right?
It's true. They're cute. Thank you, Walt Disney.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to take some questions in a couple of minutes. So if you want to start lining up there, we will entertain your questions.
One thing I want to say about deer
again.
Yes,
please.
I was in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park last spring, right at this time. And the first thing I noticed was a really healthy understory. There were everything that should have been there was there. So I asked the ranger guide, how do you control your deer? He said, we don't control our deer. I said, how come you've got understory? He said, because we've got black bears, we've got coyotes, and we've got bobcats, and we don't shoot them. So allowing predators to come back into the system. Now, they don't have wolves. That's the major deer predator.
Right.
But those were enough. We don't have black bear in suburbia. But we do have coyotes, and they're considered vermin, and you can shoot them on sight anytime. So we've got to help the system.
Right. That's part of the food web, right?
That is the only predator at this point in a lot of places. And it will only take a deer the first couple of days anyway. So,
describe for our audience here the 10-step program. What is that?
Oh, I met a woman in New Orleans several years ago, Tammany Baumgarten, who suggests that we all practice the 10-step program. Take 10 steps back from your trees and all your insect problems disappear. And she's referring to the fact that we don't view our trees close up most of the time. And if you look at an individual leaf on an oak tree, it's going to have part of it eaten. There'll be little holes in it. But you don't see them. As a matter of fact, I did a little, you know, anecdotal thing in my yard. Walking around one of those oak trees I planted as an acorn in 2014 and counting the number of caterpillars just at head height. And it was, 410 caterpillars walking around it. And then I stood back and took the picture and said, how many caterpillars can you see? You can't see any of them. You can't see any of the caterpillar damage. But if I knock on your door and say, you got 410 caterpillars just on your lower branches, get the spray can, call the man, save the tree.
So that's the 10-step program.
Take the 10 steps back. You wouldn't even know you had those caterpillars. Right. The tree is adapted to be able to share some of its food. And of course, those don't think of them as caterpillars. Think of them as bird food. If you have a plant that's making zero bird food, get another plant.
Yeah, you know? Indeed. Let's take some questions. Yes, go ahead.
You were talking all about this idea of natives and having the word weed attached to them. And it comes to a point where, as we're trying to turn our yards into these national parks, we have the cities and counties fighting us because there are various ordinances and laws that prevent us from having these weeds, quote unquote, in our yards. How do we really begin kind of talking to politicians and other policymakers to really kind of change that mentality and get them to see the benefits of having something over 10 inches, which is the Philly ordinance?
Right. Oh, wow. Great question.
The two things we have to do. First of all, those are elected officials. We have to let them know that this is important to us and they will not be elected again if they keep ignoring it. So the people who want this type of change has to be louder than the people who don't. But at the same time, we should appreciate the cultural constraints that are there and try to work with them. HOAs and civic associations are worried about reducing property value. They've got this idea that if you have a native yard, it's going to be wild and messy and everybody's property value will be reduced. That's what they're worried about. So we have to create properties that are not wild and messy. Somebody gave, I can't remember the name, Mild Wild. I like
a mild
that.
Wild. That's good.
It's simply using more natives than non-natives. But this is where the use of the lawn that you keep is important. It becomes what we call a cue for care. So if you have lawn, keep that part mowed, but you're going to have more plants in the unmowed part. So they won't say it's a plant more than 10 inches. They're going to say that's a flower bed. And of course, some of them are more than 10 inches, but your lawn is not. It's mowed. And when you do that, most people don't even recognize that you have added plants to your yard. And then you don't have the conflicts, at least not as many of them.
So there is a workaround. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So this question has to do with genetic adaptation. And the model that you have developed is we have plants and insects and birds. And the bottleneck seems to be the insects because the birds aren't too picky and the plants are kind of stuck where they are. They can't do much. But the insects produce thousands and thousands of eggs and larvae and all these sort of things. How is it that the insects can't keep up or at least slightly adapt to all the plants that we're bringing in to our landscape?
That's an excellent question. Yeah. It takes 15 minutes to answer it, but I'm going to rush through. Because it's not simply a matter of adapting maybe one enzyme. It's a matter of adapting a whole series of behaviors. They have to find that plant in this matrix of other plants, and they use sensors on their antennae to do that. They're flying around. So you have to have a mutation on those antennal sensors. Then they land on the plant and taste it with their feet. There's more sensors on their tarsi. So you've got to have simultaneous mutations in the tarsal sensors. Then they put out their ovipositor before they lay an egg and taste it one more time. Am I on the right plant? You've got to have a mutation in those sensors as well. They lay the egg, the larva hatches. Now it has to be able to physiologically eat that plant without dying. So then you have to have the enzyme mutations. And all those things have to happen at the same time. That's called host switching. It does happen, but it's very hard and it's very rare.
Talk about specialization, right?
Specialization.
Yes, go ahead.
You had talked about nurseries at the beginning. Some of my local nurseries, mom and pop shops, they said that Lowe's and Home Depot are, you know, they're struggling to compete with these corporate companies. And Lowe's and Home Depot mostly don't sell native plants. So as a result, the mom and pop nurseries, they're telling me that they're also selling non-native plants just to survive. Mm. Just last weekend, I saw someone spent $20 on a flat of English ivy.
Where was that?
Haynes, Route 130, shame on them.
I mean, how do they keep up, right?
Yeah, how do you keep them? And do you have any ideas on what we can do to help these mom and pop nurseries and convince Lowe's and Home Depot stop selling the invasives?
Yeah, we have to change the market. So right now, the demand for native plants exceeds the supply. That's a business opportunity, and people are starting to take advantage of that. But if you go to the Home Depot or any place and ask for a particular plant and they don't have it, leave. Make sure you know. Say, okay, I'm leaving. I'm not buying anything else. That's a lost sale. And that will drive the marketplace. So, you know, that's basic economics. And if all these Nobel Prizes they give out for economics mean anything, it should work.
Yeah, supply and demand.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, demand is up. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Are there any studies that compare tick abundance in the sort of the rewild landscape versus a more sterile lawn environment? Because I think one of the fears that people have is, as I'm trying to rewild my yard, is that I'm going to have a tick meadow, if you will. Right. And Lyme disease is a concern. And some of these other things that, as a kid, you'd like never even heard of are coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. We have Lyme disease because we have too many deer. It's a function of the deer overabundance. I've had Lyme disease 5 times, so
I've had it once.
It is real. But there are a few things that we can do. That's one of the functions of those swaths of grass that you keep. During May and June, the period of peak infectivity, that's where you should stick. Don't go out and lay down in the weeds because you will get ticks. If you do get a tick, pull it off and put Neosporin on it. That kills the Borrelia before it gets into your bloodstream. If we succeed in diversifying the other members of the tick food web in our yard, so if you have foxes and coons and possums and chipmunks and something other than just deer and white-footed mice, you've got the disease going in a lot of different directions, many of which are dead-end hosts. There's an interesting study in the South where they have a lot of deer and a lot of deer ticks and very little Lyme disease. But what they have that we don't have is lizards. They've got a lot of anoles and they've got a lot of skinks, and those are dead-end hosts, and the ticks get on them, and it really reduces the amount of infectivity. But the ultimate solution to Lyme disease is to get those deer numbers down.
Right. I mean, the other possibility is to have, you know, I was thinking about top-down control. I don't know how many vertebrates eat ticks.
Very few.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the question. Yes.
Hi. My question is, when an invasive species such as Japanese Paxandra, which is our current issue, takes over, how can you make sure to start turning towards more native plants without hurting the environment you already have? So, you know, some people say, like, use Roundup or start pulling everything, but then you start to hurt what's already established there around that species.
I think don't use Roundup, if I can speak for you, Doug.
You know, herbicides are a tool in our toolbox. It's the misuse and overuse of herbicides that cause the problem. Remember that 800 acres of Phragmites I told you about? That was controlled with herbicides, but you should see what a living landscape it is now. Wow. So done properly and responsibly, it's a tool. It's not the only tool. A lot of times, you know, a simple matic, you whack out these things, or you can saw the trunk and paint it. You're using very little material, very little herbicide material. But if you don't kill the roots, you'll be doing it the rest of your life. And I've discovered that I'm getting older every day, and they will win. So we've got to kill the roots, and herbicides is an important part of that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Final question. So what do we do about gas-powered leaf blowers?
Electric lawn equipment is really coming along.
It's quieter.
I have been to conferences where they demonstrated everything right up to tractors.
Yeah.
So it's available. It's available.
Well, Doug Tallamy, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to you for coming out. It's great having a full house.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was Doug Tallamy, professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. His most recent book is Nature's Best Hope. It took a lot of people to organize this event. Thanks to Tori Harris, and special thanks to Yvette Sizer, who turned WHYY into a beautiful verdant greenhouse for a few hours. Our engineers for the evening were Joyce Lieberman and Tina Calique, with help from Charlie Kyer and Diana Martinez. Debbie Builder produces The Connection with Paige Marie Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining.